appreciate committee members who are here and promptly here today, and also appreciate your being here.
How are you?
As is our custom at this time, most important item of each committee meeting is to recognize veterans or current military servicemen or women who are with us today. So if you're a veteran, would you please stand and let us recognize you and thank you for your service. And to you, we want you to know, we know that freedom isn't free, and it certainly wasn't free. And thank you for all you've done for our country. Also, before we begin our meeting today, I just want to let everyone know that we have the Veterans Fund in this committee meeting. And should, by chance, while you're testifying, you should use an acronym, we will ask you to contribute to the basket at the back of the room on the table. And that would be for the purpose of, repentance for using an acronym. So just in case it slips, and it happened to me last meeting. Also this morning, Vice Chair Farr wants to share with us something special.
Well, my father, Robert Smith, worked for the Oregon Army National Guard for 30 years, and he had this poem on his desk, and I wanted to share it with you. God and the soldier all men adore in time of trouble, but no more. For when war is over and all things are righted, God is neglected and the old soldier slighted.
Thank you for sharing that, and our purpose is to eliminate any and all slighting of those who have served our country and for freedom. Tuesday, January 25th, and we have an important presentation on today's agenda. And at this time, I would like to open an informational meeting. Now I'm going to get my glasses on so I can see what I'm talking about. Today we have invited testimony from the Portland Veterans Administration Medical Center, from the Oregon Department of Corrections, from the Oregon Department of Human Services, and the Oregon Community Colleges. And we're grateful that you're here. Also, if there are other individuals who would like to make a statement before the committee, we want to remind you that it is required that you sign up on the sign-up sheet right at the table right by the double doors. All right? If there is no other comments, let's begin with Dr. James Tuschmidt, Director of the Portland Veterans Administration Medical Center. And I would just, I'm sure you know this, but we are required to ask you to identify yourself before you speak for the record. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is James Tuschmidt. I'm the director at the Portland VA Medical Center, and I brought with me today two of my staff people, Molly Koch, who is our eligibility expert, and Michael Carlson, who's my executive assistant. And I'll start, if I may, with just a prepared statement for you all. I thank Madam Chair and the entire Oregon Veterans House Veterans Affairs Committee for inviting me to testify today. I consider it an honor to do all that I can to assist you in improving the support to returning soldiers of the Oregon National Guard. Our nation's operations in Iraq and Afghanistan bring us a new generation of war-wounded veterans. The Department of Veterans Affairs considers the care of veterans with war-related injury and illness to be our core mission. Indeed, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs has mandated that Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom, and I'm going to ask your indulgence, so we commonly refer to this group of veterans as OIF, OEF veterans.
Sorry, Dr. Truesmith, it's not allowed. I think he already now has to contribute.
The Secretary of Veterans Affairs has mandated that Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom veterans receive high consideration and expedited care. There are three Veteran Affairs medical centers and numerous community-based outpatient clinics in Oregon. The Portland VA Medical Center is a major 255-bed tertiary medical center affiliated with Oregon Health and Sciences University, as well as numerous other academic institutions. We are a national referral system for renal and liver transplantation and a regional referral center for advanced specialty care. We operate 72 long-term care beds and an outstanding physical medicine and rehabilitation program on our Vancouver campus. The Roseburg VA Medical Center provides acute general hospital services, long-term care, mental health services, including the only PTSD program in the state, as well as a wide array of outpatient services. The Southern Oregon VA Rehabilitation Center and clinics in Medford serve Southern Oregon. This is the nation's largest rehabilitation center with over 600 beds providing psychosocial rehabilitation and mental health services, as well as primary care services. Additionally, Oregon veterans may be entitled to a wide array of fee-based services. These VA purchases these health care services for eligible veterans from local community providers when they don't live near a VA facility that can provide the needed medical care. The Portland VA Medical Center saw over 51,000 patients last year, delivering over 500,000 outpatient visits and almost 8,000 inpatient admissions. We have an annual operating budget of over $310 million. That was for fiscal year 2004. The number of veterans treated has grown by approximately 45% over the last 3 years at our facility. This growth has strained our ability to provide some specialty care in a timely manner for some veterans. In spite of this, we continue to exceed private sector in many benchmark measures of quality. In spite of this, we have made many efforts to reach out to returning Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom veterans. I don't want to contribute again. And their families. All VA facilities in Oregon have held demobilization briefings with returning soldiers and with their families. Portland staff have held such briefings at the Portland Air Base, Naval Reserve Center, and the Salem Armory. Nationally, about 16% of returning veterans have sought VA care, and about 2% of these have required hospitalization. There is no reason really to expect that Oregon's experience will be any different. Of note is the fact that veterans of the regular Army are twice as likely to use VA services as are veterans of the Reserve and Guard, 23% versus 12% respectively. About 20% of those seeking care have requested mental health services. To date at Portland, we have seen a little over 100 veterans from Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom conflict, mostly as outpatients. I believe we have very good mechanisms for transitioning those with physical war-related injuries. Nevertheless, I think all of us are concerned that those with mental health issues may fall through the cracks. We have and want to continue to be more proactive in reaching out to our soldiers and their families. We could not do this without the support of Oregon leaders such as yourselves. We have been participating in very productive meetings hosted by the Oregon National Guard to develop a more integrated approach. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and the Network of County Service Officers are some of the most important advocates for our veterans, helping the most vulnerable navigate an unintended but often bureaucratic system. And finally, the National Veterans Service Organizations are vital links and advocates, and without them, we really could not do our job. Once again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I'm happy to answer your questions. Along with my written submission, I have included a map of the shows you where all the facilities are in the state of Oregon, actually Oregon, Washington, and Idaho.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tuschmidt and Molly and Michael, for coming today. First, I want to say that in my several years of being around the legislature, I have continuously heard of the excellence of care at our Veterans Administration Hospital. In fact, I've been told it's the best in the nation.
Thank you.
So I just want to thank you for that. It makes me very proud.
Thank you.
The first question that I have to ask you relates to, can we handle the ever-increasing load? And if not, what do we need to do?
By handle, you mean access to medical services for these returning?
Yes.
I think that our current wait times for primary care services are within a couple weeks. If you apply for care, you can get an appointment into primary care right now. Into most of our specialty services, the initial consultation, if you need to visit an orthopedic surgeon, for example, that initial consultation you can receive in less than 30 days in most cases. We have some specialty areas right now that are out to 80 and 90 days. And some of our procedures for surgical procedures, so if you need an elective hip replacement or something like that, some of those are out months before they will be done. Right now, we have pretty much made the care for this group of veterans who are returning a high priority. So if they come and want in the system, we try and get them their appointments within 72 hours, et cetera. And we've done that really by redeploying our resources to make them available for this group of folks. I think in areas where we have backlogs and are saturated, we can make sure that the next available appointment goes to a new veteran requesting care. What we can't do is kick somebody out of an appointment to make room for somebody that's there. And clearly, the resources to provide care are finite.
So, just to follow up, so are you saying that you have the capacity to handle the 365,000 veterans that we have in this state, plus these that will be returning from Iraq and Afghanistan?
No, we could not possibly care for 365,000 veterans who reside in the state. I think care for the 51,000 veterans that use us and provide fairly timely services to those veterans, except, as I mentioned, in some of the surgical areas. I think that the returning Guard members who will... some have come back, more will come back in March, more will come back at the end of the calendar year. I think that we should be able to meet most of the needs of those returning veterans in a timely manner.
That is good news. And secondly, you mentioned the delay caused by the bureaucratic process. And I believe this committee would be very pleased to help end that's whatever red tape. Sometime in the future put together what are those obstacles, what are causing the delays, and perhaps give us that information and let us see how we can help
Sure. We can put together some information about some of the issues that we know about. I think the veteran service organizations are very familiar with some of these issues. And I think most of them come about from the fact that the rules about eligibility are very complicated, both for health care and for other veteran benefits. And trying to understand those rules and navigate the system is, I think, the biggest challenge.
Okay, other questions from the committee? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I could not help but note, as a social scientist, that you talk about the differences between the Guard and the regular Army in the number of veterans who actually use your service. I can come up with a whole bunch of different hypotheses as to why that might be. I'd like yours.
I don't have a real answer for you. I don't know. All I can say is that data is the experience to date for this returning group of veterans that is tracked nationally. I don't have data for Oregon specifically. I guess I could put a few hypotheses out there. And one of those, I think one of the biggest challenges that we have talked about, that we've talked about at the meetings with the Guard, is really the fact that folks come back from to reserve and guard units and are really disseminated kind of across the state from where they live. And so if you are specifically kind of plugged in a more centralized approach versus coming back and being disseminated back to your home state, home county, hometown, I think access to information and to the physical infrastructure, I suspect, is much more disconnected.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned on here that you've seen your patient load increase 45% over the last 3 years. I would just be interested, where is that coming from? What generation of veterans? Is it Vietnam primarily?
It's come really pretty much across the board. I think there are a number of reasons that I would speculate as to why we've seen an increase in numbers. We've had pretty consistently for the last 3 years new applications for care at a rate of about 1,000 a month applying for VA health benefits with us. We know from talking with those folks that the economy has really been a driving force in that. People who have lost other health benefits either because they're not employed, because they're living on fixed incomes and couldn't afford medications and health co-payments and other things like that. So I would say it's really been driven predominantly by the economy, by people trying to reduce their out-of-pocket costs of health care.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. First, too, I'd like to thank the Veterans Administration for all of the great things that you do.
Thank you.
And those that you help, you know, receive exceptionally good care. Having said that, being a veteran myself, I do have a whole host of questions, and I'm looking for your comment on them. And for the very field dozer man, the first one I would like to address is the Southern Oregon Veterans Administration, not VA. You do owe us several dollars for using VA,
yeah,
by the way. The Veterans Administration clinics, so on and so forth. In Iraq, as you know, because of the improvements in medical care, we're seeing a lower death to casualty rate, and so therefore very routinely you see people with arms and legs blown off and coming back, and that number is going to do nothing but increase. Can you address that issue, these catastrophic issues, and many of them, of course, they get treatment on active duty, then they're released, but they're in our community. How does the rehabilitation center in Medford play into that? Are you seeing an increase? And is that a center where we're seeing all of the western states flowing people into that center?
The facility in Medford is predominantly a psychosocial rehabilitation program. So it's predominantly for mental health and social issues, homelessness, joblessness, that kind of thing, not so much physical rehabilitation. We have a physical rehabilitation unit at Portland. It's on our Vancouver campus. And we really have not yet seen a large number, primarily because I don't think we've had a large number of folks come back to this area. I think that those veterans will be pretty well plugged into the system. The VA nationally, all of those veterans come back, as you are probably aware, through Walter Reed or through Bethesda. VA has representatives stationed at those facilities that meet those veterans with physical injuries, go over VA health benefits, and make sure that those people get plugged in to the system when they come back. I think our ability to provide those veterans with rehab, with prosthetic devices, et cetera, I have very few concerns, actually, about those folks. I think they'll be taken care of well.
May I interject? Dr. Tishmuth, does that facility in Medford handle veterans from California, Idaho, Nevada, as well as Oregon?
The majority of the patients at that facility come from Oregon, but they literally get referrals from all over the country. So there are a significant number who come from California and come from other western states. But if you look at their roles, they've had people from literally every state in the country.
And is it federally funded?
Yes, it's part of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Totally federally funded.
Yes.
Go ahead, Representative.
Follow on to the mental health care question. I mean, we know from experience, us committee members and others, that in the mental health arena, that it's generally about 18 months after, in the time frame of up to 18 months after a returning veteran who's been in combat starts seeing psychological problems. And mind you, Representing Barney at Barnhart has marked the calendar from my day from Iraq. I'm here that day. So when I go postal,
we'll expect him to provide free care.
Right.
I'm glad somebody's watching out for you there.
Since I lean to the right, all of my Democratic friends know Betty's not worried. She's on my left hand. Your numbers and your date timeline, 16% of returning veterans, 23% active duty, 12% respectively from the Guard, so on and so forth like that. Since we haven't really hit the 18-month threshold, and we're just coming into that threshold as we speak now, and frankly because of extensions of tours, we don't have a lot of returning veterans yet, but we're going to have a whole slew of returning veterans here very shortly. And then, as we know, in the Portland area, we have the Marine Corps Reserve calling up, you know, entire battalions again for second rotations. I mean, are these 16% returning veterans, 23, that's day they have now. Are you anticipating, have you forecasted out in front of you that the problem is going to continue to grow? And how are you going to respond to that given your very limited resources?
I don't have any solid projections about what kinds of numbers we'll be seeing. I think that the delay in the mental health issues presenting is the reason I have so much concern about these patients falling through the cracks. I think that as they come back, as has been said repeatedly, most of the returning soldiers see us as an impediment to getting home. I don't think they're interested in or paying much attention, really, to what they're being told about veteran benefits and about the potential mental health issues that are there. I would say that we're going to see, for sure, a large number of people who need mental health assistance at some future point in time. And some of that may be very, transient need for mental health services. But literally we today see new people with PTSD from World War II in Korea. So it is the nature of the illness that for decades to come, these folks are going to be presenting newly to our organization, to the Department of Veterans Affairs facilities, with mental health needs. And I think that our mental health resources are constrained. There's no question about that. The funding and the availability of resources for us to expand those services are limited. But again, I think that the department has said that these returning veterans will be a high priority in the organization. And I think that if we can get to those people early, that some of the lifelong problems, in fact, may be preventable. I think the challenge is really figuring out how to get to the folks after they go home, particularly for Guard members who will disperse throughout the state, may not be near a VA facility. And as you are aware from attending the last meeting we had with the Guard, there is some discussion about how we collectively, both the federal agencies involved in reaching out to these folks as well as state agencies, can do a better job of proactively helping that veteran rather than waiting for them to knock on our door.
May I continue, ma'am?
Please.
I routinely hear from Vietnam-era veterans that talk about six-month waits, 12-month waits, 18-month waits, or basically dropped off the priority list. And dropped off is not the right terminology, I realize, but going down on the priority list based on incoming. Your own statistics, I mean, 51,000 patients, you're forecasting 1,000 a month, 20%, basically we're talking a 20% increase on top of a 45% increase, on top of the fact that you didn't get a budget increase, quite the other. What can we do as a committee, and what should be done to answer these concerns? I mean, our constituents, I mean, routinely say 6 to 18 months wait. And I know that's because they're from the Vietnam era, and we have a whole host of new problems. So we have to take care of everybody equally. So, what is the solution, or what is your recommendation to us?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that some of the wait times that used to be there a few years ago were corrected. In fact, if you go back 3 years ago, we had 10,000 veterans on a list waiting for care, and some of them were waiting on that list for up to a year. That's no longer true. We do not have a waiting list to get into primary care services at this point in time. We will once again saturate our capacity to bring in new patients. That will happen sometime later this fiscal year. And at that point, I think that you will see probably some waiting lists at the Portland facility developing again. Every year we have people who come and use the system and who do not come back the next year. That turnover rate traditionally has been about 30%, 33%. One in three veterans who used us last year will not come back this year, traditionally. That number has fallen to something around 22%. And for those who are using us for primary care services, which are those veterans who are using us as their really principal source of health care, that number has fallen down to about 10%. Will not come back. So, again, I think that a lot of that has been driven by the economy, by people who have decided to use the VA, stick with the VA, because they don't really have other alternatives that are affordable. So I think the challenge to us, the VA as an organization, is really trying to figure out how we can improve some of our efficiencies to be able to open up additional slots and capacities for these returning veterans. And I think that we will continue to make sure that they are a priority in our system. As far as what you all can do, I think clearly, again, I think that the connecting those veterans with the resources that are available to them through the VA is a huge issue. I cannot tell you how important the county service officers are, how important, I know they are not kind of within your funding bailiwick, but the National Veteran Service Organizations are, State Department of Veterans Affairs are really important links to help us to reach out to these folks and to make sure that they are connected with our organization. We do not have the resources to reach out into Eastern Oregon on a proactive basis, but every county has a county service officer, and I think that the support of those programs is critical to us at the federal level to be able to do our job and to make sure that we can reach out to the veterans who live in the kind of the more remote areas from our medical centers. And so I would say that's should be a huge priority in terms of figuring out how to make sure that they have the resources to do their job and can connect back with us.
Do you feel having the capability for these veterans to access local medical care before coming perhaps to the hospital for more serious issues would be advantageous to the workload? Prevent the need to travel 2 to 5 to 7 hours to.
Yeah, we have essentially one tertiary facility in the state. That's in Portland. So patients from Southern Oregon who need some care have to come up to Portland to get that care. So if you need coronary bypass surgery and you live in Southern Oregon or in Eastern Oregon, and you want that from the VA, you're probably going to travel to Portland. We do provide some fee care, that is care that we purchase when you're not near a VA facility. And I might ask Molly if she can address for you, talk a little bit about that fee care, about the eligibility and how that works.
Thank you.
Yes, the eligibility is...
Molly, would you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Molly Koch, and I'm at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Portland. The eligibility is very particular for fee care, and it's based mainly on service-connected disabilities. There are some other eligibility requirements. A patient who receives aid and attendance benefits from the VA is eligible for fee care. But mainly it's for veterans who have a service-connected disability, meaning some injury or illness that occurred while they were in the military or as a direct result of military service, that they've filed a claim with the regional office and been rated for that disability. And then those patients are eligible to receive care for that disability while in the community. And then some veterans who have 50% service-connected disability or more are eligible for any care in the community that's limited in the dollar amount that they can get on a monthly basis. It's mainly for primary care. But if they need surgery or specialty care, that either needs to be authorized by the VA or it's available at the VA, depending on the cost of the care and what it is and if we can provide it or not.
So, Molly, how do you apply for this?
Well, they can apply directly with the hospital or just by calling the VA or by contacting their veteran service officer in their community, or they can go to their national service officer, or they go to Disabled American Vets or American Legion. So they can apply any number of ways. They can apply online through the VA website.
But if a veteran is facing an emergency, can he just go to the emergency room of his local hospital and you will cover him, I hope?
Well, there's eligibility. It's complicated eligibility that all revolves around that. And some veterans who are having an emergency, who are enrolled in VA health care and are receiving health care through the VA within the past 24 months, and it's a true emergency, and a reasonable person would have gone to an emergency facility, we would consider that, and we pay that at a reduced cost if the veteran has no other health insurance. Some veterans also have eligibility for emergency care that we would pay at the full rate. But again, those are mainly service-connected veterans for their disability.
Thank you for that information. Would it be possible to have you give us a document of how veterans can access local care?
It is complicated.
I see that. And in talking with the local administrator, because I have sponsored the bill now every year to allow veterans to access local care, it's a bipartisan issue here. You know, we continue to support our congressional delegation in lobbying for that opportunity. Number one, it's a cost saver. I can recently recall in my own county, a veteran who went to a local hospital and instead of receiving service there was sent by ambulance to Portland. The difference in the cost was $1,200 versus, you know, $50 of insulin. And to me, you know, that's where we have some situations that are not cost prohibitive. And especially since you haven't gotten an increase in your $10 million budget with this tremendous increase of patients, which I'd like to know why, and I will certainly be asking that question, but it seems to me that, you know, like our hospital administrator told me, we're happy to accept any and all veterans, just get the paperwork situation changed so that we can do so and so they can be reimbursed. And I wonder, do we work on that in any way?
Yes. For the veterans who are getting emergency care who aren't eligible under fee basis, so they're not, they don't have eligibility for us to pay for their care, and that the VA is the payer of last resort, and they don't have other insurance, and we're paying at less than Medicare rate, there is quite a bit of paperwork that's involved with trying to get that paid for. And we've taken steps to try to ensure that our providers know what the paperwork is required so they can send it in as they send in the bill rather than get the bill, send the bill back, get the paper, oh, they forgot something. So we've done a lot of community outreach to make sure that they know what they need to provide to us before they even send us a bill so we can take more quick steps on getting the bill processed.
And how many veterans, or maybe you want to research this, have met the requirement and have been served by local hospitals? Do you keep a regional count or a volume of dollars? It would be interesting to me to be able to tell medical institutions that, I mean, here's $50,000, you know, $1 million of new business for you if you will accept our patients.
Well, we have that information. I don't have it available.
We'd appreciate knowing that and probably help us.
We can get
you some help.
We can get you some details. We purchase tens of millions of dollars of care every year in the community. And in fact, the amount of that care that we buy instead of producing ourselves has gone up tremendously over the last few years. And I don't have all those figures in my head, but we can put those together and get you the data about what we buy and how much money we spend on those kinds of things.
That would be wonderful. And if I could just ask, because this is always on my mind, do you have different treatment programs for different branches of the military? For example, does the Oregon Guard get the full same benefits that the Army or Navy or Marines, Air Force get?
In the Veterans Affairs, there's no distinction between what branch of military you were in, Coast Guard, Army, Navy. It's all, everyone's a veteran.
Everyone's a veteran?
Well, everyone who meets certain eligibility.
That's a very important issue to us.
I think there are differences, though, between folks who come are regular Army versus Reserve and Guard. In terms of eligibility.
Yes, but not as far as the treatment. When a person is enrolled in the VA, they're eligible for any health care the VA provides. And it's not dependent on if you were a guardsman, you only get this treatment. But there is eligibility requirements to be accepted into the VA for health care.
Could you also... I know you're going to love this, and you need more work, but we would appreciate knowing the difference, you know, why we treat a reserve serviceman differently, you know, with the same wound that a regular Army or
I'd just like to clarify that there are certain people who serve in the military who aren't necessarily eligible for VA health care, so it's not...
And who would that be?
Well, it's going... Veterans who's... Less than 24 months prior to 1990, the first Gulf War, those veterans are not eligible for VA medical care if they don't have a service-connected disability. So there's, yes, an entire set of criteria for people to be considered. But currently, anybody who's serving over in Iraq, for example, would be eligible. Care provided they have an honorable discharge from the military.
What about those who are serving here supporting those over there?
If they are regular Army and they've completed their tour of duty, then yes. If they're National Guard, who are National Guard and activated but have not been seen in an area of imminent danger, then they are not eligible. So someone who's working down in Salem but never gets sent overseas would not be eligible for health care.
And would it matter how many days if they served 179 or 180?
No, not for health care purposes. I know there's some criteria with that with the regional office for some types of benefits, but it doesn't apply to health care.
I told you.
Yes. We just want to do everything we can. I mean, we feel that our veterans have been greatly appreciated and respected, but we do feel, you know, that they have not received the benefits that they deserve. I mean, their sacrifice, their commitment, their dedication to far exceeds anything we'll ever do. And Representative Boquist, did you have...
I have one final question. I believe Representative Farr over there is...
Okay, I was going to let you finish, and then we'll go to her.
My final question is for the moment. 16% of returning veterans, which are those coming to the state which have seen combat action over 180 days and are presently have a combat ribbon to justify that they actually were there or proved that they were there, therefore qualify for Veterans Administration benefits. 16% of those you're seeing credits. 36%, correct me if I'm wrong, Colonel Caldwell back there, 36% of returning veterans from the Army National Guard are unemployed. That number correct? 30 to 36%. They are eligible for 6 months for TRICARE, which is a whole totally separate issue of whether TRICARE is good or bad. But obviously, if you're seeing 16% of returning veterans, do they not have TRICARE? Has their TRICARE already expired? And what is the linkage? I don't say formal linkage, but if they don't have health care coverage from TRICARE, or there's problems with TRICARE, they come to see you, because they're eligible for you because they have TRICARE. And is there something we can do to strengthen the TRICARE system, even though it's not your bailiwick? Because if they don't get TRICARE, they don't see you. They come see the county and the hospitals and everybody else. So they're coming to us no matter what happens. Everybody that falls through the crack is coming to us. And so obviously we're trying to get a tiered response here. So rather complex here, but you know, I think you know what I'm talking about, Doctor.
Yeah, and you know, the truth is that I really know very little about TRICARE. It's not a Department of Veterans Affairs program. I suspect that returning troops have an array of options like many people. They have TRICARE available to them. They have the Department of Veterans Affairs available to them. They have private local services, healthcare services that might be available to them. And they make choices about what to use that is probably based on a whole array of things about expediency, cost, availability, et cetera. So, I can't answer the question really about, you know, why someone uses us versus TRICARE, et cetera. I don't know much about how TRICARE works really for these folks.
And Madam Chair, for the record, I had 6 months of TRICARE, and I don't know much about it either, which tells you that there's a problem.
Well, thank you for that information. Representative Boquist and our good administrator will get TRICARE in here, and we'll learn everything we wanted to know. Representative Farr.
And Representative Boquist, I want you to know that you owe me now, okay? Next time I have a question, I get to go first, okay?
I will concede, Representative.
Thank you.
I like this amicability.
Going back to the mental health issue, what does the treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder consist of?
I can't answer that question. I mean, we can get you some information. It's not, although I have an MD behind my name, I'm not a mental health expert, and I can't really tell you, but I'd be happy to get some information together for you.
That would be great. And then also follow-up question, how successful is the treatment? If you could include that piece.
We'll get that information for you. I'd be happy to. We have lots of experts, and I'm sure they can put a paper together for you to explain that.
And, Doctor, do you have personnel roster? I'm curious of what types of physicians and support personnel maybe your assistant could get.
Sure,
that for
we
us.
Can get
how
you.
How many psychologists to 51,000?
We could get you a breakdown of the various employees that we have in by, you know, professional category, for example.
And how would that compare with the rest of the state? Us who are not risking our lives for freedom. I mean, the ratios. Would you have any facts
like
on
what
that?
Kind
we would
of,
appreciate it.
What kind of ratios are you thinking?
Well, for general public, you know, is there in most vicinities, you know, is there one psychologist for every 2,000 patients? I'll ask Dr. Barnhart.
I'm not sure I have that kind of information. I think that there's a big difference between the VA and a lot of the private sector healthcare in that if you look at us and compare us to a Kaiser Permanente has some staffing ratios, you know, how many vascular surgeons do they need for so many enrollees. The difference there is that Kaiser has a lot of enrollees who don't use the Kaiser healthcare system. All of the people who enroll with us use the VA healthcare system. It's a huge difference. So even if I had the numbers, I'm not sure they would really be comparable. But I can get you a breakdown of how many physicians we have by specialty area, how many nurses we have, how many social workers we have, that kind of, we have that information I can get to you.
Well, the reason for that, we just want to be sure that we are staffed up adequately and properly to handle our service
Yeah, we have professionals that provide a full array of services from general medical care. We have a full-time ER staff with emergency room physicians. We have a wide array of mental health providers from psychiatrists to psychiatric social workers to psychologists on our staff. We have an inpatient unit that's a locked unit at the Portland facility along along with outpatient programs for PTSD, addiction, general mental health services. We have a methadone maintenance program. So I think there's a wide spectrum of services that are available, particularly in the mental health arena. There's nothing that comes to my mind right now that doesn't exist at the Portland facility in terms of trying to meet the needs. I think, and I might just mention, we have programs in for homelessness outreach. In fact, the Portland facility was really the first place in the nation that went into a partnership with a number of other private and local entities, and we built on our Vancouver campus. I realize that's Washington State, not Oregon, but on our Vancouver campus, built a joint venture, which is a single resident occupancy building. So homeless folks, it's a transitional housing program that's jointly managed by the VA, by Clark County, Washington, and by a number of private entities to provide essentially low-rent housing, apartments, as transitional housing for people, and veterans have access to 50% of the units in that building.
Great.
So I think there's a wide array from homelessness intervention, vocational rehabilitation, to acute mental health services that are available for returning folks. I think, whether the resources are adequate to meet the demands that of the returning folks, time will tell.
And how about an increase in drug use? Have you seen this occurring?
I can't say we've seen an increase in drug use. I can tell you that, and I have that data, actually, about 20%, these are, again, national figures. No one has broken the data out for Oregon, per se. But about 20% of the folks who have been seen by the VA have requested mental health services and been seen for mental health issues. And of those, about 26% have been seen for 26% of that 20% have been seen for substance abuse issues, either non-dependent, 22% for non-dependent substance abuse issues, and 4% for dependent substance abuse issues.
Is that of the 500,000 that were seen?
That's actually of 258,000 veterans who have come back nationwide.
So do you contract with any specialty centers, Emanuel for burn cases, Providence for heart? Do you have any private partnerships?
We have numerous contracts throughout the state, really, for care. We contract for virtually all of our orthopedic care, for example. We do not have an orthopedic surgeon on our staff. We lost our orthopedic surgeon a number of years ago and have had great difficulty recruiting one, primarily because of physician pay issues. We can't pay in our system an orthopedic surgeon what they can make in the community. So that's been difficult. There has recently been federal legislation passed to adjust the pay scale for us so that we can be more competitive.
Right.
But that has not come through at my level yet in terms of being a tool that we can use. It's still in that process. But the legislation has been passed. But we contract for all of our orthopedic care. We contract for some neurosurgical care. We contract for ENT care.
For what care?
I'm sorry, I owe you another buck.
Good.
For ears, nose, and throat surgery. Got to watch myself.
I misheard that in addition, so that was very helpful.
Well, for him, though, he's a physician. It's a dollar.
a dollar.
We're kidding. Reverend Farr reminds me we said 25 cents.
Thank God.
But I liked your dollar better. Okay. Anyway, okay, ear, nose, and throat, neuro, and neurological, and ortho care. Are those the contracts?
Oh, we can get you a list of what we contract for. We contract for all kinds of things. Are probably, on a volume basis, the biggest person we contract with and buy care from is from Oregon Health and Sciences University. Is probably our biggest, but we have contracts with all kinds of places.
That would be very advantageous. And I'm also curious on the cost for services, how you break that out.
Sure.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, having been in that Vancouver homeless facility, it's an amazing facility. And we may actually want to look at that as a potential model in terms of a partnership, because it not only stabilizes the obvious housing needs, but it really stabilizes medical needs, employment issues, and it's really a great partnership. I had completely forgotten about that.
Yeah, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Roseburg VA did a similar project a few years ago. So there's also a single resident occupancy building on the Roseburg campus, I believe.
If I could follow up, Madam Chair, perhaps we could get our committee administrator to give us some information about those two. That may be of interest and possible precedent setting for us. I'm interested in following up, though, about, you talked about the increased amount of care that's provided outside the VA hospitals that you're reimbursing at private hospitals, if I understood you correctly. Do you have the sense, is that resulting in some, based on the reimbursement rate that you're able to provide, is that resulting in some kind of a cost shift where not only are they seeing a larger percentage of veterans, but they're having to provide care that they're not getting fully reimbursed for, so it's increased? I don't know if it would be increasing the charity care load or if there's some other
in play there. Our reimbursement rates are set nationally that we pay if we... we do negotiate contracts with individuals outside of those rates. I would say generally we can contract close to the Medicare payment rate. Occasionally, if something is very scarce, we may pay more than the Medicare rate. I think the highest that we've gone up is about Medicare plus 10%. I'll get the details together as we talk about the contracts. We can tell you kind of what the payment rate is relative to Medicare, which is the benchmark that we use. Sometimes we can actually contract for less than Medicare. I think in the Portland area, when we were going out and looking to contract a couple years ago for urology services, we were having a hard time, and so we paid a premium actually for those services. I think that's the Medicare plus 10% that sticks in my mind, because we didn't have enough urologists. I mean, they were all booked up, and there were, I don't remember, something like 10 vacancies for urologists in the Portland area, and so we had a hard time. And the ones we had took a few of them and said, we can't take any more, we're full. But generally, you know, with a few isolated exceptions, we have not had difficulty contracting at Medicare plus or minus a few percentage points. And I'm not working in private sector healthcare in the state of Oregon, but you know, I think that most people would probably put Medicare payment rates somewhere in the middle of the bucket.
Doctor, how many or what percentage of our patients have other insurance or are veterans? Do you know?
Total veterans?
Of the 51,000 we serve.
Of the 51,000.
How many of those have outside insurance from their employer or privately?
Well, about 10% of veterans that we see have other insurance, but A lot of that is Medicare, and we cannot bill Medicare, so it's around 6 to 7% that have billable insurance.
Okay, are there any other questions?
Ma'am.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Beinhart.
We have touched on a large number of different topics that are related to capacity and utilization, things of that sort. I'm wondering if as part of responding to those questions, you could include the approximate waiting list length. And I'm thinking more about time than numbers.
We track that in terms of days to next.
And that would be helpful because, of course, it gives us a rough measure of how far out things are. There's always going to be some waiting list for most services, but question, of course, in time. Another question I have, and this one is a little harder to word, so let me give you a preamble. We're familiar with the reality that when an executive branch agency comes to testify before us, there are some questions that are difficult for them to answer because of the separation of powers issue and the reality of the governor's budget and things of that sort. Are there constraints on questions that you can answer as a result of similar policy issues? And if so, what are those constraints?
No one called me and said, you can't say this. I would presume that I can say whatever, answer whatever questions you ask me faithfully and honestly. I think that...
then I have a follow-up.
Yeah, I don't think there's any constraints in me answering your questions.
Okay, then my follow-up question is, can you describe for us what the Veterans Administration asked for budgets for the current fiscal year, and if it's the appropriate time for the next fiscal year, and what the responses to that were in terms of both the budget proposed by the President and the budget adopted by Congress? I think those are things I don't know. I don't know whether other members of the committee knows, but I'm sure that at some point in the chain they're public records.
I have no idea what's being proposed for next year. We do have information about this fiscal year. I don't have those numbers in the top of my head, but we can again get that information and get it back to you. We do have that information.
One last, if I may. Several other members of the committee have alluded to the interplay between veterans' benefits and support for veterans that are picked up by the community in some other way. I don't know if there are ways that you can quantify that in any degree, but if there are, I think it would be useful to know about them. Services that people might get while they're on your waiting list from other places, because as you know, our capacity to provide funding for services for people, not just veterans, but for anybody, is severely constrained right now.
Right. We can go back and kind of think about that question. I don't think we track, what. I'll be honest, I mean, we have a hard enough tracking our own data, much less other people's information. So I'm not sure if we would know what services, particularly from a monetary point of view, veterans use while they are waiting for care from us, for example. There is no question that the operating budget at the Portland VA Medical Center has not kept up with the growth in new patients and the demands of those patients. So the fact that we have 45% more people, and those folks who use us are not leaving. As I said, that turnover rate has gone down substantially, particularly for people enrolled in primary care, which means that not only are they coming for that one visit, but they're coming back and using us for a full spectrum of health care benefits that they weren't using us for before. And there is no question that strains our system. Every new veteran that enrolls in our primary care program within the next 12 months will generate 2 subspecialty visits, and 30% of those people will use mental health services. So there is, a finite set of resources available to care for the patients that come to us. And I would be foolish to suggest that it's a panacea there. I think that over certainly the rest of this fiscal year, which is all I can speak about, I think, with any degree of fidelity, I do not have concerns that returning Iraqi or Afghanistan veterans will have the capacity to take care of those folks. I think that the bigger concern for me, at least over the next 12 months or so, is really, I think, the issue that you touched on, and that's the returning veteran who has mental health issues. And because they are not going to be connected with our system. They have not been identified up front. And my concern is that many of those folks are going to have issues that are, when they present, they are not going to present to the VA. They're going to present to the criminal justice system. They are going to be homeless. They're going to be off living up in the mountains in tents. They are going to fall and drop out of society. And my concern is that is how do we, and if there's anything I think that you all in the state legislature can do is try and figure out how can we proactively reach out to these returning folks and create an infrastructure and a set of supports that those returning veterans can turn to. And the VA does not exist in every county in this state. I mean, while we can provide care locally, get people to come to us, or at times fee that care out, we do not have bricks and mortar facilities in every county. And so it's really that gap. I mean, if there's things that keep me up at night, it's that gap in the support services that are available and the kind of the tragedy of people falling through that crack.
We certainly thank you all for being here, and we want you to know how much we appreciate you, Dr. Fushmith and Molly and Michael. Thank you so much for coming, and I just want to say God bless you for caring so much about our veterans.
Thanks. We'll get you your information, and I'll leave a contribution at the door.
Thank you so much. At this time, I would like to call on Dr. Fred Smith. And I want to mention that this is not Federal Express, this Fred Smith, but we certainly appreciate Dr. Smith taking the time to come all the way from Klamath Falls to be with us to discuss our veterans and educational opportunities for our veterans. And if you have support personnel with you today, have them please be seated, and as they speak, we'll ask them to introduce themselves.
Thank you. I'll start.
Huh?
If you like, I'll start, or you can start.
For the committee's information, I might just mention that I was so pleased to attend a meeting and find out that there are educational institutions in the state that do put our veterans first and provide them an opportunity to get an education without tremendous cost. And this happens to be one of them, and we appreciate very much, Dr. Smith, your being here.
I'm going to have Lori start.
Would you identify yourself, please, with a microphone?
Okay.
Thank you.
I am Fred Smith. I am the president of Klamath Community College in Klamath Falls, Oregon. And also, for the record, as of January the 12th, 2005, I learned that I am the Oregon Air National Guard Employer of the Year.
Well,
so,
all right.
So I have another title to add, but we'll talk more about that in just a few minutes.
That is wonderful.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Satinspiel, Government Relations for the Oregon Community College Association. We'd like to thank you for inviting us before you this morning, and Fred introduced himself. I've got Pat Martin from Mount Hood Community College and Tom Moore with Chemeketa Community College today. When a man and a woman, or a woman, return to Oregon after serving in the armed forces, They need more than gratitude. They need job skills and training to ensure that they can return to the civilian workforce. Oregon's community colleges are working hard to ensure that they have the classes and the support that they need. Last year, the community colleges provided 7,700 veterans with training, most of these in the professional technical field, which leads directly to jobs. Across the state, we trained in business, nursing, criminal justice, maritime sciences, electronic technology, fire science, chemical dependency counseling, and aviation maintenance, to name just a few of over 200 offerings. Some colleges offer to our veterans free tuition, and there's other local boards considering that option. Some colleges have made scholarships available to the Oregonians currently on active duty. At one college, veterans are allowed to defer payments at no charge until they receive benefit checks. In each of our colleges, there is advisor and support personnel to intercede with the Federal Veterans Administration to ensure that the promised benefits to the men and women who earned them are there. Other colleges have special tutoring services available to assist them in the reentry into the academic world. Our colleges serve as advocates and champions for our Oregon's returning veterans. When the claimed benefit is wrongly denied, when an award amount is incorrect, promised bonuses are not forthcoming, the community college staff members go to bat for the veterans who defend us around the globe. When a veteran's educational goals go beyond what the VA has for their changes, the community college personnel work to identify what other resources are available and get them into the process and get them the access. As they do for students across the state, Oregon's community colleges provide solutions for our veterans. Having served in defense of our country, they're now preparing for the economic recovery. And with that, I want to turn it over to Fred.
Thank you so much.
If you drive into Klamath,
once again, Dr. Smith,
for the record, Fred Smith, president of Klamath Community College.
Thank you.
If you drive into Klamath County on any of the major highways that lead into our county, just like every place else in the state, it will say entering such and such county. If you drive into Klamath County, it will say entering Klamath County, we honor vets.
Oh, love it.
My board has 7 members who have 1 employee, and that is me. 3 of those members are Vietnam-era veterans. So it comes as little surprise that our institution will do things and bend over backwards for veterans. We work very, very hard. We do little things for veterans. We have two units in Klamath County. We have an Army Guard unit and we have an Air Guard unit. When individuals need specific classes to get into officer training school, we will run single classes for folks to try to get them what is necessary to get them to their schools. We've had some of our staff that have been called up, and we've worked very hard to work with them on their return back. But most importantly, what we did this year was, you need to understand that the presidents of Oregon Community Colleges are a competitive lot. And the president of Southwestern Oregon Community College, who is a naval veteran himself, challenged all of us last May to do something for our veterans.
All right.
And Credibaugh put it out to us as a challenge, and I thought I could pick that up for our institution. Now, when we started to do the mathematics, and as you learned this morning, there was nothing simple in the military. One of my board members is a former training officer at the Air Guard base. And so when we started to work through the process of offering a last dollar scholarship, we had a difficult time because there are no less than 8 different financial aid packages for individuals in the Guard and Reserve. So to try to keep things stupid simple, which I try to do on a regular basis in my organization, we said, all right, let's keep it real simple. If you were called up and you went into the campaign theater area for 30 days, you're still in the military or honorably discharged, you have made application to your financial aid, made application to federal financial aid, if you still have expenses left, the Klamath Community College will pick them up. That's it. End of subject. Mm-hmm. We're done. So if there's anything left over, we will pick it up. Now, that will set us, we're going to run this program for at least 10 years, and at minimum, we think we have about $400,000 outstanding in this little game. A lot of people are a little bit afraid, and I simply told my board, I said, well, I go, if we spend too much money, I'll stand out on the street with my tin cup, because in Klamath County, I think I'll get people who will give me money for the veterans. We are a heavily veteran area, and we don't have any problems doing this. For us, this was a simple decision. I have an executive team, and they want to do what is right for the organization. And they argued with me for a long time because we don't know how much money we're going to get this session. We don't know what facilities we're going to have. But I told them this would be one of the few opportunities in their professional lives that they're going to get to make a decision because it is simply right. And so that's what we did. You know, some of our board members did basically the same thing. They're like, man, you know, we don't know how much money we have. And I said, guys, we're going to get the opportunity to do what is right. This is right. These folks went out and they put their lives on the line for us. We can pop a few pennies. We can help them get a good job. We can train them. We can help them transfer to the Oregon Institute of Technology or any other university in Oregon. This is right. So we set up a scholarship. We call it the Ryan P. Kelly Memorial Scholarship. Ryan P. Kelly was killed in action last summer in Iraq. Our institution is not very old. He is our first student who has died in action. Now, he was an active Marine. We ask his family, and we use this primarily today for reservists, but I push my board, and they push me back. I believe if we have some active individuals who come in and say, hey, what about us, I think I can go to my board and say, I've got some active individuals who are requesting the same thing. Do you think we can do this? I think my answer will be yes. I don't think I'll have a problem with my board. But there are other institutions in the state, as Lori spoke to. Of course, Southwestern Oregon Community College has done this already. We picked up and did it. Rogue, I believe, is acting on it this month. Their board is acting on the same type of activity as we have, Columbia Gorge. And I can't answer for the rest of the community colleges in the state, but I believe that by the time it's all over, most everybody will be there. We're locally controlled entities, and once the local gets wind of this, they'll push us this way, I'm sure. But that is our institution. I don't know if you have any other questions for me, but we're just going to do right by our folks who are there. Questions?
We are so proud of you, Dr. Smith. Do you have a projection of how many veterans you're going to be handling?
We will have upwards to 400. And the question for us is not so much the number, but where they're going to fall out. We pushed, let's see, pushed is probably politically incorrect. We asked that the Oregon Institute of Technology join us in this because we weren't certain where veterans would fall out on the continuum of credits earned. And they, in a heartbeat, joined us and said, okay, we're going to stand shoulder to shoulder with you, KCC, and we'll do this with you. So what we say is if folks have under 60 credits, they should deal with us and work towards an associate degree. If they have more than 60 credits, they should be starting with the Oregon Institute of Technology and work towards their baccalaureate degree. Now, that doesn't mean that if they have more than 60, we're not going to take them. That's a non-issue. But, you know, our goal is to try to get them the most advanced degree as quickly as we can to get them the best job opportunity that they can get. And so OIT has stood next to us with this. So.
Well, for years I've heard about and I understand GI stands for government issues. I've heard about the GI Bill, mm-hmm. as it's referred to, and is that still in effect?
Actually, we work with the Montgomery GI Bill, and there is a new piece of legislation that was just signed into law in October. Let me get that for you. Let me see if I can cite that for you. Let me pull it up here. Okay. I'm going to read you from the Educational Benefits GI Bill website, and it said, new educational benefit for activated reservists. H.R. 4200 authorizes the creation of a new educational benefit and was signed into law on October 28, 2004. The new benefit, Chapter 1607, makes certain individuals who are activated after September 11, 2001, either eligible for educational benefits or eligible for increased benefits. The Department of Defense and Homeland Security and VIA are working on implementation plan for this new benefit. At the time, we are unable to provide more general information about Chapter 1607, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on. So we may get some additional help, so it may cost us a little bit less to do this, or other colleges were interested in doing this, but that just came up. So we're doing our best. We're going to help them out, and hopefully we can get them to very good jobs very quickly. That's our goal.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Farr.
I have a question for Lori, and Fred, you may have already answered this question because you mentioned that along with Klamath Community College. See, there was another community college you mentioned as well, Southwestern Oregon Community College. Are there any other community colleges that are currently offering this free tuition to veterans?
Chair Nelson, Representative Farr, there are a few, and I can get you exactly who those are. There's some other local boards who are actually looking at this as offering this as well.
Could you get me that information?
I can.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Okay, Ms. Martin.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Pat Martin from Mount Hood Community College, and I'm the Associate Vice President of Student Development and Services there. So I'll take a little bit different tack, and actually listening to the VA doctor kind of put me maybe going into this vein, is that my position is to try to serve all the students with the myriad of services that they need to have to be effective and get their degrees or move on to the four-year colleges and universities. And one of the things that the VA doctor mentioned was that there'll be many of these students coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan that perhaps have issues but are not able to use the VA services. So about a year ago, I started thinking about what we can do for our veterans. We've had for years a veterans clerk who's basically a high school person who facilitated the high school grad who facilitated the veteran benefits. But I thought that we needed to offer a higher range of services to these students, particularly as more would be coming back from the war as it ends. So what we've done is we've a few different things. One is to identify someone in our academic advising office that would reach out specifically to veterans as well as their other duties. Also, we started a veterans forum where we invited any veterans we had on campus, and currently during this past year we had about 386, and this term we have over 200, which is an increase, and that includes dependents, by the way. And our first meeting we had a couple weeks ago, we had about 25 veterans and dependents, and a very interesting group from a widow of a Vietnam vet to someone who just came last week or 2 weeks ago from Iraq, and about 22 years old. So we're working with those students to give them a forum in a confidential way, and it's facilitated by one of our counselors to talk about the issues, and we have some staff members who are vets from the Vietnam era, to talk about some of the issues that they're having coming back into the academic arena, particularly some of the 20-year vets who are having difficulty in more of an academic as opposed to a military environment. We do deferment for the tuition for the students through the term, so they don't we expect payment the first day of class, and so we don't expect that since their bills often come in, you know, their checks every month. We also have our disabled student services office work with our VA person to look at the coordination of services with the VA for the voc rehab and disabled vets to ensure that there's some services that we can also give on campus that are covered by our Perkins money, which is part of the voc rehab act for higher ed, to try to help those students. We have the Veterans Administration provides us a 30-hour a week work study student who just finished actually at Mount Hood but now is at George Fox, but is working for us 30 hours a week to work with the students and also works on tutoring with those students. So we have a variety of services, trying to offer them a comprehensive service. And through, I think, that veteran Veterans Forum, which we hope will be a club but also a support group, we'll identify students that might have issues that we may have to do referrals for them to social service agencies or hospitals and those kind of things. So, but what's really primary in my job, which is for all students, but veterans are one group, probably about 3 or 4% of our overall student body, is to provide them services so they do persist, because it's not just what goes on in the classroom. It's often outside what's happening with them. If they meet other people on campus, if they connect with their faculty members, if they connect with staff members, and that's really what we're trying to facilitate, so it's a comfortable environment for them.
Pat, what's the delta between what this what the federal government will pay for education and what you charge at Mount Hood?
Basically, everything's covered, including books and
totally covered.
Yeah,
by
it depends on the
program.
Different benefits that they have. I think that there's some people who have gotten extra educational benefits if they've signed up for specialties within the military that were in demand. For example, some that maybe in the probably not aviators, so to speak, but some of those more technical areas. Some of those students may have gotten even more money. But generally, students have pretty much everything paid for, including their books. Now, we also work with coordinating with the financial aid office to make sure there might be some other things that they may need. And we have the college has, you know, our own scholarships who we have facilitated those from, you know, their private money through a foundation to help those students if they need some other things such as, you know, cars, you know, helping with, you know, paying for cars or whatever. We also have a group of senior citizens that work on campus that have kind of a food bank and also give short-term loans. So perhaps if someone needs, and that's for all students, but particularly for these students, if their monies have not come in from the Veterans Administration, the GI Bill, that they will be able to, you know, take a loan for a period of time.
Okay. Great. Any questions?
Madam Chair,
and
I don't think community colleges necessarily have the answer for this, but I think at some point we need to get our arms around what are the federal benefits, because I believe obviously the community colleges in many cases are higher institutions, mm-hmm. get tuition, so on and mm-hmm. so forth, but it still costs to live.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how is the veteran themselves paying for food and clothing and everything else? And as you heard earlier, 36% are unemployed, so we know not through a job.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very different.
We would appreciate, yes, very much. And should any of y'all have information on that, well, we'd certainly appreciate receiving it. And get it to Jim, or we can all disseminate the information.
Representative Nelson.
You have to identify yourself again, please.
Fred Smith, Klamath Community College. When we were doing our process, we were lucky because one of my board members was the former training officer at the Air Guard Base, and so he gave me this wonderful document, this spreadsheet, and it had, like Representative Boquist had requested, I mean, there are a plethora of military assistance programs for education, and they're all based on different criteria that just is, at best, is confusing to me, and but he knew it cold, and all the acronyms and those kinds of things, but there's a lot of them, ma'am. Let me assure you there, so that's why we just said, look, you're not going to have any bills. We're just going to go. So.
Great. Well, we would appreciate having any of that information that you could send our way. Okay, Tom.
Hi, my name is Tom Moore from Chemeketa Community College. And actually, I'm here with Chemeketa. It's Chemeketa Day here at the Capitol. And a friend of mine, Lori, that I've known for a number of years, asked me just about a little over an hour ago if I would come in and speak. So I don't have any prepared notes or anything, but actually I'm here to talk about not only community colleges, but my own experience as I'm a Vietnam Marine Corps disabled veteran. And when I first got out of the Marine Corps, I actually used benefits myself, so I can take a look at, I used the old GI Bill for the first 2 years that I went to college. And at that time, I went to Chemeketa Community College, which was their first 2 years that they offered lower division colleges at classes. And as far as community colleges, the size of the classes and the quality of the instructors. Looking at this myself, using my first 2 years there, was just excellent. I don't think that I would have been able to go into a four-year institution at that time. In fact, looking back at some of the issues that I didn't really realize that I was dealing with at that time, which had to do with some of the things that I guess you could look at as some mental health types of things, even though I always considered myself pretty mentally healthy until a certain point in my life, many years later. And I still consider myself mentally healthy, however. I did use GI Bill first couple years, and after I went down to school down at Oregon State University after that, and I went to school then on voc rehab for disabled vets at federal system. At that time, prior to that, they had changed that. When I first got out of the service, I only got a 10% service-connected disability. I have a 30% at this time. But Vietnam era vets, we had to have a 30% to be able to go, where World War II and Korean War were 10%. They changed that law at that time, and I went to undergraduate on voc rehab for disabled vet, worked for the state for a few years, and then I went back to graduate school across the street over here at the Atkinson Graduate School at Willamette, and got my master's in business administration going on voc rehab for disabled vets, which was very good. They paid tuition books and fees. There's no other way that I would have been able to personally attend and go on to further my education without those benefits at that time. I stayed with education, instructing and working with the present program that I work with at Chemeketa for a number of institutions as an adjunct faculty at Chemeketa. And over the years, I have worked with a number of veterans that, and we talk about some of the things as far as, I look at it as marketing and the veterans having to know that these things are available to them. I run into veterans every day, even in the program. One of my standard questions that I ask veterans when I'm screening them for their background to make sure that, it, and not veterans per se, but all students, I will ask them, are you a veteran? This is standard. I think it has something to do with being a veteran myself, and I try to talk with other counselors and people that are working with things to make sure and put that into their questions, because I think it's overlooked in many, many cases. And if a person doesn't realize that they are a veteran, to make sure that they look into and see that they have the benefits that are there. I have a perfect example. Just within the last year, a gentleman that's about my age, a Purple Heart recipient from Vietnam Air, didn't ever really consider himself disabled. I don't consider myself disabled. I mean, I think there's a big difference in between handicapped and disabled, and there's some things where they might have to deal with that. Oh, physical ailments, and then I know a lot of people who are coming about having issues many years, decades down the road. I myself ended up having some issues. I joined the Marine Corps in 1966, and after the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, I was instructing a class for Chemeketa Community College over at Staten and at the Santa Ana campus over there. And I was listening to the radio, and for years I didn't believe in things like PTSD or flashbacks or any of these kind of things. And I'm driving back after my class, and all of a sudden this whole thing comes into my head, and I'm going, oh my God, what's going on? I'm listening to these Scud missiles come into Tel Aviv at the time. And it brought back things to me that I had to go over to my mother's and say, hey, did I ever say anything about this? I had zeroed it out of my head. It was gone. This never would have come out. My mom said, yeah, you wrote a couple letters about it, and that was it. And I said, why didn't you ever say anything? Well, you never said anything. Well, something to deal with the issues with the veterans, and I heard a little while ago that World War II and Korean War veterans and stuff, I see this happening with much, much more much prevalent, and not only the present veterans. I think that in a time of war where we're at in Iraq and Afghanistan at this time, these things really affect veterans per se, not only combat veterans but other veterans that were backup veterans, etc. And I'm trying to figure out where I'm going from this. Some of the things that ended up dealing with me is I ended up having and using many years later, just right after the Gulf War thing, I ended up using some of the veterans facility myself. It's called the CARS unit up in Vancouver, Washington. And I think one thing for myself that I needed is I needed to go back and answer some of those questions of way back in the 1960s to be able to, these are things that affected me close to 30 years later. And if I wouldn't have gotten that help, I don't think that I would be sitting here as a professional, as an educator today. I might be one of those people up in the hills up there or something, you know. Yes.
Mr. Moore, we want to thank you for your service.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Does Jamaica offer some educational benefits for our veterans?
Presently.
Or is it like Mount Hood?
I think it's presently, I think it's something that is just beginning and there's some discussion going on. I know I have personally talked with some of the other people in the careers, in the different career centers, and I work throughout the career centers with the program that I work with, Occupational Skills Training, which offers training to, I work with a lot of dislocated workers myself. However, veterans are another group that I foresee coming down the road. And I think I try to get this information out to other employment and training specialists and counselors and those people to ask those questions about veterans. I was telling a story about a gentleman who had gotten a Purple Heart from Vietnam. He said, nobody has ever asked me whether I really qualify for anything. I didn't really ever think about it or anything. Well, I said, I want you to go down to the Veterans Administration. This is one thing. I have people do a checklist. I want you to apply for financial aid. I want you to look into the services of the different career centers for the Workforce Investment Act. See if you qualify for these different types of things. And one of the things, do you qualify for veterans benefits? He went down and checked it out. He is getting 50% service-connected disability, dealing with not only physical but some of the other issues that he had, that which really ended up bringing him to the point of where he was working with me, needing services to be re-educated.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad that you're there to counsel these individuals, and the experience helps, I know, in tying in with them and having empathy and more understanding than those of us who've not served on the battlefront. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions of this group? And thank you all for what you're doing as far as education. I'm most grateful. And next we'll call on Scott Taylor, who is the Chief of Community Corrections.
Chair Nelson, committee members, my name is actually Tom.
You can bring your assistant up here, if you'd like.
Colette. my name is Tom O'Connor. I'm an administrator in the Transitional Services Division of the Department of Corrections. My area is religious services. I'm here working with Scott Taylor. Scott Taylor asked me to be here today. I think there's two important figures that you need to know, really, in terms of veterans. The two major things, I've given you a report there with some statistics on it, but the first point is that there's about 14%, we estimate, of the people who are in state prisons are veterans of some sort. So that means that it's about 1,700 people currently are in prison at the moment who are veterans. Now, estimating then, given the number of people who get out every year, it means that there's about 560 people being released from prisons every year who are veterans. And that's people we open the door for. I don't mean people escaping. That's people who just, it's time to leave. So 560 people. The big thing that we're doing in terms of working with veterans is we do ask at the intake center, we do an assessment of people's criminogenic needs, the things that are risk factors for people about getting involved in crime when they get out again. And we try and do a treatment plan while they're in prison that continues on into community corrections when people get out, working with the community corrections. So we ask people in terms of that information that we gather, their veteran status, what branch they worked for, when they were veterans, and a few questions about their veteran status. So we're trying to work with Director Jim Willis with the Veterans Affairs and Bob Rapine from Housing to see if we can coordinate a better response to the people who are being released, the veterans who are being released. I think that's where the major work we're doing in terms of veterans is going on at present. Jim Willis is working on a housing project with Bob Rapine in Multnomah County area that will be focused on some of the people that are probably leaving our Powder River Correctional Institution, where they're doing a treatment program at the moment for drug addiction and other serious criminality factors. And the hope is that this house would be available to continue the work of supporting these people when they get out from the prison, so that they've just gone through a whole treatment process, they're being released into the community. We don't want them to fall back into the cracks. So that's the kind of thing we're trying to do. There's another initiative going on in the department, and the current director has really put a focus on transitional services in the department. He has reorganized the department into a transitional services division and an operations division. And really, the transitional services division is the people who are involved in the treatment aspects, trying to reduce people's risk of recidivism so that when they get out, they have a better chance of making it, and so that the public is safer. So it's within that area of those treatment services that we're working a Home for Good in Oregon program, which is a kind of a partnership between community corrections, Department of Corrections, faith-based organizations in the community, and community organizations with people like the Veterans Affairs, the Housing Affairs. And that is an effort to beef up the reentry efforts for people returning, to help them with jobs, help them with mentoring, help them with social support. And they're kind of key aspects. Services alone won't help people stay free from crime. We really need services, but we also need treatment around helping them with their thinking that justifies their criminal attitudes and their criminal actions, and really pro-social support. So these are veterans. Now, they're also inmates, so we know some people think, you know, it's a bit more difficult to support inmates, but when people get out of prison, they really do need that kind of social support. That's the programming that's going on at the moment in the department. I would say that today, in preparing for this committee, I uncovered a few areas where I think we can beef up our services to veterans, because I think really we have the information, we're collecting it at the intake center, but we're not getting it into the hands of the counselors quick enough. So I think there's a few improvements we can do to our computerized system of tracking the information we gather and getting it to the counselor. So we will be working on that in the department. That's something we can do right away.
Out of the 1,700 inmates who are veterans, do you have an age brackets for these individuals?
I don't have age brackets, but I can get them. I can break it down for age. I will do that and send it to you. But going on our age bracket range, most of them will fall, I would say, in the 30 to 45 range.
And would it be possible to know the types of crimes they have been involved in?
Yes, I can break that out as well.
Would you say that the majority are drug-related?
No, the majority are going to be person-to-person, because 70% of the people who are in prison today are in for a person-to-person offense. So that's because of laws that have been passed within Oregon. We don't have a high rate of people who are in for drug crimes, but 70% of the people in prison do have substance abuse issues. So they may not be in for a crime.
Percentage?
70% approximately. Yeah.
And would it be possible to know what types of employers have you worked with who are most willing to hire these veterans?
We are making background. Yes, we can get you a list of the employers that are working. We are finding, you know, that some employers are very open to working with ex-offenders getting out. So they're the people that we're trying to build a network of employers who will help people when they get out.
Just to
let you know that we did have a conference a couple of months ago in Bend where we had 300 people attend the conference, and it was a re-entry conference from people all over the state. It was the first in the nation. It was a conference focused specifically on people re-entering from prison, because we do know that 95% of the people in prison are getting out, so they're coming back to people's neighborhoods. So if we don't build the capacity to reintegrate them, we're perpetuating problems.
Well, is it true that 80%, there's 80% recidivism of those who cannot read?
I wouldn't say it that way. Literacy is an issue, and we do have a literacy program in the department. So literacy is one of the factors, but it's not the major factor in predicting recidivism. The major factor is your associates. If you don't have any people who are pro-social, who your friends are, you just have other criminals really that you're hanging out with, and you're thinking the kind of thoughts that you use to justify your behaviors. So it's those kind of programs that really are the most effective in reducing recidivism. But you need, if you don't do the literacy, those programs won't work. So you need to do the literacy as well. We estimate that we think about 25% of the veterans are Vietnam, from the Vietnam era.
Any other questions? Yes,
Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. O'Connor. I should know the answer to this question, but what is the population? 14% of the prison population is veteran. What is the population of veterans compared to the state of Oregon? Are we higher or are we lower? My guess is we're a little bit higher.
We're a little bit higher. I was listening to the first presentation, so I think based on his figures, Dr. Tushman's figures, it sounded to me like he was saying about 12% of the population. So I think we're a little bit higher, but not double the amount.
Yeah. Thank you.
Do you, Tom, do you see differences in, the attitudes of, this may be ludicrous, but of the inmates as far as built-in anger from veterans for what they've had to face and see versus others,
I think you're hitting out to something. That's certainly an issue that a lot of people have. I mean, again, it's person-to-person crime. A lot of people are in prison, so a lot of them definitely have anger issues, and I'm sure they're exacerbated by the service experiences that they've had. So we can't run enough anger management programs. We have waiting lists for them, so that's definitely an area that people need help with.
And could I ask, is there a shortage of jobs for these veterans who are returning?
There is a shortage of, people leaving prison definitely have difficulties getting jobs, and so the veterans are definitely going to be affected by that. Their skill level often is not high, and often they, as the first Dr. Tushman again, it's the people who really have fallen through the cracks. So mentally, they've kind of withdrawn from society. They're not attached to work. They're not attached to their families as strongly as most of us are, and it's that process of becoming reattached. And I will just say this too: we focused a lot this morning on the needs of people, the needs of veterans, but the people in prison, even included, even though they've fallen through the cracks, they do have a lot of strengths. They have a lot of abilities. They have a lot of strengths. So it's really it's how to work with the strengths of these people as well, and help them, get in touch with those strengths and find a place to use them in society.
And is there enough funding for this activity?
I think the director is really trying to focus, as I said, on this transitional services division. So the governor's budget is supporting the work that we're doing there. Just so you know, the balance of money, though, in the Department of Corrections still goes into the incarceration side, not the treatment side. So the huge most money goes into the operations side, and that's what we need to run the prisons. If you're looking for the real change in behavior, it's in the treatment budget. It's in that money. So, there is most of it, I say, is over in the operations side.
Any other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Boklis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you say again the percentage you thought that were Vietnam veterans?
In the department, it's 14%, we estimate.
14% are?
Are vets in some way.
So, no, I mean specifically from the Vietnam era.
At least 25%. If you look in page 2 of the report, yes, it's at least 25%. It's probably more than 25% because some people didn't answer that question when we asked them, what period did you serve in?
I guess, Madam Chair, one thing, and I'm not sure he has the answer, but the thing that I wonder about is that now that we're in a Vietnam era, we had people, of course, struggling anger management. People who were obviously came out of combat who had anger management issues, mental health issues, is a higher rate that we have than what we would normally see of the population. So now that we're coming out of a fairly heavily combat rotation period, we haven't made the 18-month cycle. I think one of the things that was brought up in the meeting that I attended and Representing Hunt attended was the fact that the concern that we're going to see more, because we're in combat, we're going to see more mental health problem issues and more criminal issues because we haven't really had a period. I mean, the 100-hour field training exercise we had back in Gulf War I is nothing compared to what we have now. It's been basically since we pulled out of Vietnam, that era where we saw all those anger issues, mental health care issues, so on and so forth. And so the statistics we look at from 1975, which is a mythical date because it was actually 1973 when last combat troops fought, until almost right now or the next 6 or 8 months, those statistics may not be valid because we're going to see a whole host of these issues coming back in. And that's why I wonder if, you know, this 12% of the population versus 14% of the population, whether that number suddenly is going to be a big jump here as these people start coming back from the Gulf War, from Afghanistan, from Iraq, or other places like that. And so I'm thinking that if there's any skew in the statistics, we're actually going to see a larger bump. And I'm not a mental health care expert, and I think Representative Farr has far more experience in this area than I do. I'm on the other end of the spectrum. But I'm concerned that we may miss the boat here, that the number is actually going to be much greater than what it looks like statistically. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So our prevention program.
Yes, I think Dr. Tushman was right. He said about catching these issues early rather than let them going on for years. So often mental health issues exacerbate in the absence of social support and the absence of community, absence of knowledgeable intervention. I think that is the key. And it's also in that kind of area, too, where these antisocial attitudes develop. If you can only really develop this kind of criminal thinking really in isolation from other people. When you're with other people, they won't let you think those ways. So it's really crucial about the fabric of social support. That's the crucial.
Well, based on spousal input gotten since we went to Afghanistan and Iraq, the input from spouses here is great concern. Mm-hmm. For what they personally need to be prepared for. So I guess I'm curious, you know, that's something we need to work on. What are we doing right now to prepare, you know, the families for what's going to happen in March when the 162nd comes home, for example? I mean, when all of them come home, but just because I know that's a large group.
Yeah, that's a great parallel.
Important, I think.
I think that's a great parallel. I was talking to one of our chaplains who's an ex-Army chaplain for many years and worked in programs for helping people come home. They had a transition program to reintegrate people back into the families. It's very similar to what we're trying to do with people coming out of prison. So you're absolutely right. The wives and the children and the husbands of people, they really need some support.
Thank you so much for being here, and we're most grateful, and I hope you'll let Chief Taylor know we appreciate your coming.
Thank you very much.
And we'll go now to the Oregon Department of Human Services. We have Deanna Hartwig, and Nancy, is Nancy Horn here?
Madam Chair, Nancy is ill today and unable to attend. However, I did bring her presentation materials and have provided them to
you. Appreciate that. Thank you. Okay. Will you proceed?
All right.
And identify yourself.
Yes, I will. I am Deanna Hartwig. I am the administrator of the Office of Federal Resource and Financial Eligibility, Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. I'm here to inform the committee about the role of seniors and people with disabilities in ensuring that veterans receive all long-term care benefits to which they are entitled in Oregon. In addition to the Oregon Health Plan benefit packages described in Nancy Horn's material, seniors and people with disabilities offer long-term care services to individuals who meet financial and service eligibility criteria for Medicaid or state-funded programs. Veterans may be eligible for Medicaid-funded home and community-based care, state plan personal care services, or food stamps if they meet the applicable financial and or service priority levels. During the application process to determine an individual's eligibility conducted at our local offices, staff will ask all applicants questions regarding income, resources, health insurance, disability, and services desired. Since Medicaid is the payer of last resort, applicants who may be eligible for veterans benefits will be asked to pursue those benefits. Individuals who have veterans benefits may still be eligible for senior and people with disabilities long-term care services if the program-specific financial and service criteria are met. Seniors and people with disabilities does not have special programs for veterans, nor do local offices have specific staff who process applications from veterans. Seniors and people with disabilities staff receive and process applications for benefits and services in the same manner for everyone. The Seniors and People with Disabilities have worked directly with the Department of Veterans Affairs to enhance client awareness of veterans' benefits through messages on department medical cards and information and application packages. Seniors and People with Disabilities intensive training sessions often include the Oregon Department of Veterans Administration to talk about veteran eligibility and to help screen for veteran services before Medicaid. This is a valued and continued relationship between the agencies.
Thank you so much. Can you explain to me, just or simply maybe, at what point would veterans qualify for long-term care, and what does that mean?
Seniors and people with disabilities have a service eligibility criteria for both nursing facility services, our home and community-based waivered services, and state plan personal care services. This is often referred to as service priority levels 1 through 13. Some of you may be familiar with that. There is a standard assessment that is conducted on all applicants once we determine the financial eligibility. So a veteran who meets our financial eligibility criteria, who also meets one of those service priority levels 1 through 13, would then be eligible for our long-term care services, which may be nursing facilities, it may be assisted living facilities, adult foster homes, residential care, or in-home services.
But I guess I'm concerned because they may not access Medicaid.
They have to meet the same financial eligibility requirements for Medicaid that the state has established for the Oregon Health Plan benefits and for our long-term care services, which is typically 300% of the SSI standard. So if you have less than approximately $1,700 in monthly income and your resources are within the $2,000 limit that's been established, you would qualify for Medicaid. Whether you can get services would depend on your meeting of our service priority levels.
And Deanna, would you know what percentage of our veterans in the state are using this program, and how could we get that information?
As I said here, I anticipated you may ask that question. I do not have that information available, Madam Chair, but we can certainly get that for you.
Would really appreciate it. And also, I wonder whether it's White City or the Dalles. I'm curious, since we do not have a multitude of veterans' homes and health care facilities like we seem to have for the private sector. Mm-hmm. I would like to know where they go.
Okay.
If it's possible. Any other questions for Deanna? Thank you so much for all you do, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have Wayne Sharp here. Thank you. This is a very special issue today, so thanks for being here.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and committee members. I'm Wayne Sharp, and I'm here this morning representing the Travel Information Council. Part of our duty to the council is to try to restore the historical markers that are around the state of Oregon. And if you look at your blue brochures that you have in front of you, it lists all of them, and there's in excess of 100 of them. And at this point, we've done about 34 of them. They represent the the different trails that the pioneers came through the state of Oregon searching for gold and so on. And the particular one that I'm concerned about this morning, and that we are, is the historical markers down at Camp Adair. If you're not familiar with them, but during World War II, the federal government came out and they were searching for acreage someplace to train the many men that would be required for the conflicts in Europe and also in the Pacific theater. And they found a place down there at Camp Adair, which is, they took over 50,000 acres down there. And they trained four different divisions, and each division consisted of approximately 15,000 men. And then these different divisions were dispersed for additional combat training and so on throughout the United States, and then were shipped overseas. And our fund that we have normally that we do these markers with is we get it through grants or donations. And at this point, we're out of grants, and we are looking for some funds that we can probably restore this sign. And we feel as though it's very important because it's part of our history. And we wanted to continue to show our veterans that we appreciate what they've done. And if you read my letter that I have attached along with the photos, and in there it pretty well explains approximate cost.
And that's the $20,000 is what you need? And how long would that last?
Well, we're going to probably try a different process this time. If you notice, it's a fiberglass embedded material. It's wood with a fiberglass over top, and it should last many more years than what our regular routed signs that are at this point in place. The routed signs are routed approximately a quarter of an inch deep, those out there, and the paint over a period of time chips out of the letters and it fades. And so by doing the fiberglass, it should last an extra 10 to 15 years that we anticipate at this time. So,
and this is Benton and Polk counties.
This is in Polk County. Yes, Benton County. Yeah.
So, has the tourism commission visited with you on this issue?
You mean the Travel Information Council?
Tourism.
No, they haven't right at this point.
Okay.
No.
Well, I'll be happy to bring this up to them also.
Okay. Yeah.
And we just want to compliment you on your efforts.
Yeah, well.
And thank you for caring.
Thank you. And I thank you very much for listening to me.
And I hope that we can. Are you a veteran?
Yes.
We want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
We appreciate your service.
I'd like to make one more comment. I got going on this, and I have sent out some, it'll be pretty close to 50 different contacts with all the different veterans organizations in the state of Oregon. And also, I've worked with Paula Brown, who's the assistant administrator of the Veterans Fair. And in the month of March, when the Veterans Newsletter comes out, there will be a picture in there of the flag area, and also there'll be an article in there about what we can do. Now, that goes to pretty close 7,000 different members, so we hope maybe through the donations and that we can try to find the funds to restore this site. So,
well, thank you so much.
Thank you, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify today who isn't signed up? If not...
Madam Chair, for the good order, just want to quickly point out Tamara Brickman and Jim Booker came and visited me yesterday in regards to a note I sent over to them about their testimony. And under the good offices of Representative Hunt and the idea of Representative Barnhart, the Employment Department is going to be posting signs in their offices about veterans, and they're going to be reinforcing to their front counter staff in all of their offices across the state the veterans benefits to ensure to direct veterans to the appropriate location so they can get the benefits they deserve.
Thank you so much. We appreciate all your efforts.
For the record, Madam Chair, Representative Farr also requested that information.
And you know what? I think I think we all worked on that.
You could talk to them, Madam Chair. They did Representative Hunt, though.
And I appreciate your efforts. Thank you so much, and this meeting is adjourned.